Welcome to another edition of Valley Voices. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, your host. Joining me today is longtime Roaring Fork Valley resident and historian Larry Reinierson, father of KDNK's own modern Marty Reinierson. One thing Larry does and does well is writes books about local history and landscapes. We're going to talk about his most recent, published this year, titled Legends of Glenwood Canyon, a history of Colorado's premier river canyon. It's a lovely, easy read with wonderful photos spanning the 19th, 20th, and 21st centuries. There are maps and plenty of facts and maybe some trivia. Welcome to the show, Larry Reinierson.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, your books are wonderful. I really enjoy them, and I really enjoyed Legends of the Glenwood Canyon. Why is it titled Legends of the Glenwood Canyon?
Well, you have to understand the word legend. Originally, the word legend meant a story that was passed down that may or may not be true and cannot be verified.
Oh.
And so a legend could be true or it could be false.
Okay. Well, these stories seem like they're pretty fact-based.
They're, most of them are the truth, probably 90% of them. I did sneak a couple into the book, though, just for someone to find. If they find it, that's good. If they don't, that's fine, too.
So you, what did you put in, some phony facts?
Well, I put in some information that really couldn't be true. Oh. And if you stop to read it and think about it for a while, it is true.
Uh-oh, I must have missed that, or I must have just taken your word for it.
Well, that's probably the best.
So you're not going to tell us where that is?
No.
Oh, I'm looking at the book right here.
I thought that and the word legend has been changed, too, and is changed, because now it's used for someone who is the best in what he's doing.
That's right, a legend in his own mind,
yeah.
In his own time, or whatever, yeah. That's true.
I don't know if I should sneak this in here or not, but Lead King Paul is known to a lot of Valley people, and I've known Lead King Paul since I came into the Valley.
Who is Lead King Paul for people who don't know him?
Paul Harris, and he lives in a cottage, in a cabin, up on in the Lead King Basin.
Lead King Basin.
Lead King Basin.
It's up above.
But I told Paul his own concept of himself. And I said, Paul, you're a legend in your own mind.
Yes. I bet he got a kick out of that.
Yeah.
There are some really interesting characters in the history of the area.
Mm-hmm.
And I was amazed that there's so much history and so many stories just within the Glenwood Canyon.
Yeah. 12.5 miles long, the canyon is.
Yeah.
12.5 miles long. And the history is short. It's 1887 is when the railroad came in.
Well, this is the white man's history.
This is what?
This is the white man's history.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's white man's history.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, there is no proof that the Indians ever lived in the canyon.
Okay.
They were at the western end of the canyon, under Soapress Mountain and so on. There's probably only one site that is proof of the fact that they were on the other end, and no one talks about where it might be because nobody belongs looking for Indian
sites. It's a sacred site.
Yeah, it's a sacred site.
Well, I remember I don't know if you were here for the United Ute Powwow in 93. I think it was, 94?
I've been to all of them, so I think I would have been
this
at that
is,
one.
Yeah, this is the one that was in Glenwood.
And yeah.
The three
at the gym in Glenwood.
Right.
Yeah,
and
I was there.
The three Ute nations got together for the first time in 150 years. And I remember they were here for several days, and they made trips out to the canyon to look at those sacred sites.
Yeah, I'm sure they would have.
Yeah, or a sacred site. I don't know how many.
Pretty much A, and it's on the eastern end of the canyon.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know anything about it, and you're right. We have no business knowing
anything
about it.
Some things shouldn't be remaining a legend or a mystery, one of the two.
Exactly. You know, you have chapters in this book, Larry, on carbonite, the pool, No Name, Ranchers, Caves, Hanging Lake, Grizzly Creek, Jack Roberts.
Yes, Jack Roberts.
Talk about Jack Roberts.
Jack Roberts came out of Oklahoma City. He was a graduate of the University of Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
He was also an alcoholic, but he came out here for some reason and we're quite not sure what, but he was hired on at the Hanging Lake Stables as a stable boy, as a
the
horse
Hanging
procurer.
Hanging Lake Stables.
Yeah.
They were down below.
They were down below. They weren't up at the lake.
Uh-huh.
And he was one of the cowboys there that took people up to the lake on horseback. But then he also took up painting, and he took up what we will call comical painting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I actually was blessed by being Jack's neighbor, just a house apart in Redstone, a little area called Ranch Acres up there.
Mm-hmm. And that was with Tony Antonides and Charlie Drew and all of those guys.
These guys were all good friends.
Uh-huh.
Charlie Drew was a great glassmaker.
Mm-hmm.
It took an interesting character to make a living up there.
Mm-hmm.
And still have, something to do, to work. Jack was one of my favorite friends.
Talk about him a little bit. Why was he such a favorite friend?
Well, start out with, we both were Jeepers. We both had Jeeps. Mm-hmm. And we would often take Flatlanders, as we call them. Anybody that's not in the mountains is called a Flatlander. Yeah. So we'd take the Flatlander on little cruises.
Mm-hmm.
We did a lot of time out in Lead King Basin. It was our home base sometimes. And so that brought us together a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And we were also both recovering alcoholics.
Mm-hmm.
And that kept us as friends, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that went on until he died. And then by that time, I had moved on out of that part of the valley.
Mm-hmm. Right. His paintings are everywhere up in Redstone. They're in the Redstone Mansion. I've seen him at Buffalo Valley down here in Glenwood Springs. They're all over the place.
His paintings?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
He is still considered very outstanding and pricey in some of his stuff.
Yeah, I bet his stuff is pricey now.
There's a chance, and you can edit this out if you have to, but there's a chance that there's a number of his paintings that are going to go on the market pretty soon. Who from a particular person who wants to sell the whole set.
Oh, man, that'll be expensive.
And that would be, but it's going to be interesting to see what's available.
Right.
I actually, when I had a gallery, I had an art gallery in Redstone for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
I was an amateur wood carver, and Jack was helpful to me there, too. He taught me how to hit 3D real easy.
Oh, neat.
And so that's another reason why we hit it off real well. But we enjoyed each other's company. He was kind of a fun kind of a guy. He had a girlfriend in town there that had her own home little store. And
I heard he was kind of a wild man in his day.
He could be considered that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He wasn't obnoxious in any way. Nor braggadocio, if that's the correct word. He was just
a good
old boy.
Yeah.
He wasn't a redneck. Mm. He loved the people he painted. And the people he painted are important all over the country, all over the states, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he did some comical, I think that's a great word, comical scenes of yesteryear, cowboys in the saloon and
the madams.
Right.
Yeah, and the bar scene where they had to have guys at the bar.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite still is, and it's most people, is the cowboy in the little bathtub.
Right. I remember that. Yeah.
That's never been available. There's never been a print made of it, and I don't know who owns it.
Mm-hmm.
But
it gets a lot of
cover. Now, this again, I can add in. And that is that there is now a written book about Jack Roberts, fully written book.
Mm-hmm.
Daryl Munsell wrote it, and it's excellent, and it's worth buying just for the pictures.
Yes, yes,
so,
it is.
Now, if you want
that's
to
a good
use
plug
that.
For that book,
yeah,
definitely. Well, you also solved the mystery about the origin of the name Dotsero.
Yes,
fill us in on that, will you?
Okay, there are several ideas that people have about Dotsero. One was that it could be the name of an Indian princess.
I've heard that one.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It would be an Indian princess. There were two or three others, but the one that I chose to select and write about, was that Dotsero with a Z is a starting point for surveying.
Mm-hmm.
and they go out from it and come back from it. Mm-hmm. My guess is that when they got ready to leave the valley, that they left lying in the ground somewhere, and there's a guy who claims he has seen it, lying on the ground somewhere with that on it. And so he picked it up and took it to a neighbor meeting and says, here's the answer to our thing.
Okay.
But now there's still a mystery.
Okay. So this is a legend.
Yeah, this would be a legend. Here's the legend. Why is it not Cerro, the Spanish thing? Well, it's possible because Spain was all over this part of the country, and legally so. Mm-hmm. I mean, they bought it and used it. So it could be that just... maybe the surveyor was Spanish.
Yeah. So your solution to the mystery is still a mystery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. There probably never will be a solution, but there could be legends.
Okay. And this is one of them.
This is one of them.
Okay. So we can argue with confidence.
Yeah.
That this is one of the reasons why Dot Zero is Dot Zero.
Yeah, we have a writing of a couple of gentlemen who show up in another book, but that were verifiable. They could prove that they had seen this plate said Dot Zero.
Okay. Well, one of the most impressive chapters of this book is the construction of I-70 through the canyon. I was here when that happened, and mm-hmm. I remember the canyon before I-70 went through it, as you do too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just that crazy narrow two-lane road winding around. Just a real thrill in the wintertime.
Yes.
I never liked to go to Denver
in the winter. It wasn't very wide when it came alongside the river often.
No.
You had a flat tire, you had to sit in the river and change it.
There you go. You know, and it was icy and shady, and oh boy, it was creepy in the winter.
It didn't deserve to be called a road. It was a trail.
It was. Yeah. It really was. And it took decades for I-70 to be completed, you know, from start to finish.
Mm-hmm. Talk about 30 some years.
Talk about that story.
The first picture that you can see in this book shows the beginning of the construction of the four lane, but it also shows that they were taking the rock out and shoving it into the river wherever they felt like building it up.
Oh, wow.
And so it's because of that the Citizens Committee said, all right, let's call a halt to this whole process and let's take a look at what can be done correctly. Mm-hmm. And so they had, one of the families put together a good video that's still available to be seen, that it could be done correctly. It could follow the river, whereas the railroad went straight lined and built the things into the river.
Mm-hmm.
The railroad was the first road through the canyon. Mm-hmm. And that kind of shows up on this first picture, too.
Well, I really like this history of the I-70 through here, not because I'm an I-70 fan, but this goes back so far into the 1950s. And, you know, you talk about Pete Cabrina. I remember Pete Cabrina.
Mm-hmm.
I used to dance with his daughter in a dance company. This involves so much Glenwood history. You know, KGLN, the radio station. It involves John Denver, you know, and when he threw the rock across the highway. Talk a little bit more about some of this history of this story.
Let me deal with John as long as you've mentioned him. There was a man by the name of Mark Skrotsky. He was a butcher who lived in Basalt, who decided that we don't want it for, at any expense, we do not want a four-lane highway. And he was going to prove that it was too narrow for a four-lane highway.
Okay.
And so he went to John and got John involved with this process. Mm-hmm. And I have a picture of several times in the book, of Floyd Nemelson and a guy by the name of Nelson and Skrotsky and then Denver. Denver tried to throw the rock across the river. The first four tries landed in the water, and the fifth try landed on the edge of the river on the dry land.
So it took him four tries to prove that it was too narrow
The... and so it really wasn't too narrow. He couldn't throw a rock across it to where it was. And so he finally just stepped aside from Skrotsky and backed out of the picture.
But that sort of stuck with him. That was a media event that stuck with Denver for quite some time.
I'll just mention this is color, and you can take it out if you don't want to, but my brother and I had a restaurant in Aspen in the 70s.
And great time to have a restaurant in Aspen. Which one?
It was called Don Giovanni's.
Okay, sure.
It was Northern Italian. We had live music. Sandy Monroe started a group called the Bluegrass Salad Boys there, and they played out of our room. And John would show up often. I've sat and had a drink with John several times. I was in charge of the bar. We had four or five girls working a bar, and we had a very active bar because of the fact that a lot of musicians showed up in there. But anyway, so John, like I said, I knew John and Annie, and they're both good people. And John, if John hadn't felt it was necessary, he probably wouldn't have dealt with Skrotsky. But for some reason, and this is part of the mystery, that we don't know why he did it.
But right. It wasn't a very good publicity stunt for him.
No.
Not at all. But being in Aspen in the 70s and being in the Roaring Fork Valley and the Colorado River Valley in the 1970s, it was so small. Didn't it feel small to you? I mean, it's like... There weren't very many people here, and probably the ranchers who had been here for decades thought it was crowded then.
Yeah, right.
But for us transplants, it's like we knew everybody.
Yeah, it used to say that there was an off season, in those days, where you could stand at one end, shoot off a 310, and it wouldn't hit anybody. Otherwise, it was very quiet in off season.
Very quiet. Nothing going on.
I enjoyed my leaving time in Aspen, and it's what kept me here in the Valley eventually. I started house painting out of there and then stayed here and became a painter and worked my way over and lived in Redstone for about 10 years and enjoyed that. But anyway, the river, the story that's in here, written by Floyd Demos, is worth the price of the book, as far as I'm concerned.
I want to take a brief break and just let people know that you're listening to Valley Voices, and my guest today is Larry Reinierson, longtime Valley resident and author of The Legends of Glenwood Canyon and other books. Speaking of Demos writing this chapter, you had several guest writers write for this book. Talk about that.
Okay, yeah. I decided to use people who were actually involved with it rather than me writing for them.
Okay.
A good example is a man by the name of Barry Dunston. Barry's father, George, was one of the three people that started what's called the Bear Ranch.
Oh, that's out in the middle, sort of in the middle of the canyon,
yeah,
B-A-I-R Ranch.
The B-A-I-R Ranch. Barry Dunston was a UPS driver, and for 30-some years, he was living in Glenwood, but for 30-some years, he drove over to Eagle, where his deliveries were made, and then he'd come back in the afternoon. He, for the entire length of the construction of the canyon, Barry was there all day long.
At Bear Ranch?
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyway, Barry wrote the story on the ranch. I used Floyd to write the story on the, I invited him to, and he came willingly, invite the story on the length of time and the steps that they made.
And for the I-70 corridor.
On the I-70. And then the other person I used was Rick Reinhart, who is the senior caver for the Grotto of Colorado.
Okay.
And he helped Steve. Together, they were the ones that laid out the new fairy caves, did the wiring and changed
for
it
the Glenwood Caverns?
For the caverns,
the Adventure Park?
So Rick was the one that was involved with that, and so he wrote that chapter. Steve was excited about the way it came through.
Now, you wrote some of this, though? Some of the shorter chapters in here,
I wrote everything but those three.
Right,
everything but those three ones.
It's a phenomenal book. It's short. It's less than 100 pages, but it's packed with all kinds of neat stuff. I love the photographs. What was your favorite part of researching this book?
Oh, it's kind of like Christmas and opening packages. You'd be getting excited when you found out that this is really true or this is not true. For me, mm-hmm. I wasn't trying to spread a lot of untruth.
Legends.
But the legends, yeah. It was just fun researching. I love research.
Mm-hmm.
I've been a historian almost all my life.
Have you?
Early on, it was in high school, and then I carried it into college mm-hmm. and finally into some other businesses.
Well, you're good at it.
Well, I came from doing a lot of learning and mm-hmm. a lot of doing it,
mm-hmm.
but I enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I could spend 2 hours, and if I didn't get anything out of it, I'd have something new.
Right.
I may not use it, but mm-hmm. I'd have it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we just have a few minutes left, believe it or not, and you brought with you another book called Colorado's Historic Mountain Passes. Now, when was this published?
2014.
Okay. And photographs are by Rick Jones, who's a longtime Glenwood Springs resident who has just moved to Cedar Edge?
Cedar Edge, correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and talk about this book a little bit. It's absolutely gorgeous.
The way I got into it was I've done a lot of the passes mm-hmm. as a hobby, never as a business, just as a hobby. And someone said, why don't you write a book about it? And so that's how we got started.
Okay.
And there are 92 passes that still have a road over them that could be used. Maybe sometimes it would require off-road type passes.
Okay.
But
92 passes in the state.
That's just the ones I chose to write about. There are a few more. There's some horse trail passes,
right.
for example,
uh-huh.
and some hiker passes. The requirement on the ones I chose was there had to have been a road built over them for some reason.
Okay, like a road that a vehicle could travel on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. More than four-wheel drive.
Right.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
paved road.
And so the book is sort of a look at history of the Western
mm-hmm.
Slopes.
I'll say.
That's why I call it history. And again, we have colored pictures as well as black and white.
Well, and Rick Jones's work is fabulous. I mean, he had a studio in Glenwood for many years, and he's a professional photographer and just beautiful landscape photographer, and you were really lucky to be able to partner with him, and he with you.
He actually was a graduate of the photography school up on CFC.
You're right. Do you have a favorite pass?
Peak?
Pass.
Pass.
Mm-hmm.
I'm usually asked that question, my answer sort of is I've got several.
I bet out of 90,
yeah.
how can you have one?
Yeah,
you
couldn't have one.
Yeah.
Eight or nine or ten.
okay.
But, I like McClure Pass, even though it's mm-hmm. just a low one. It's pretty.
Mm-hmm.
It's got good scenery off of all sides. I guess my favorite road pass would be probably Engineer Pass.
Where's that?
Engineer Pass takes out of Ouray.
Okay.
And goes up and goes over the Continental Divide and comes down into Telluride.
And so you've traveled over all of these passes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, many times. We go every fall. We've done this for 20-some years.
Mm-hmm.
My wife and I and a bunch of friends out of Denver, we go the day after Labor Day.
Okay.
And spend a week to 2 weeks. We camp or some of the gals like the bed and breakfast
mm-hmm.
In Ouray.
Mm-hmm.
And we do passes. Every day we ride a different pass.
Wow.
But we don't do it with the idea of let's hurry up and get it done so we can count it.
Right.
We'll take along a lunch. We'll do some rock climbing if somebody wants to climb or go into a cave if somebody mm-hmm. wants to go into a cave.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, yeah, it's all the passes, they're probably all favorites except for maybe one or two that are really terribly rough. And we've got one of those right close by, and that's Pearl. Pearl Pass is a poor excuse for a road.
Where is Pearl Pass?
It comes out of Ashcroft and heads up.
Okay.
And then drops down into Crested Butte.
Oh, okay.
It goes into Crested Butte.
Wow. Well, Larry Rynearson, this has been a fascinating half hour, and I'm so sorry that it is over. What's next for you? Do you have another book cooking?
I've got two of them in my head, and one of them I'm working on. I'm going to switch genres, and I'm going to write a book called Larry's Encyclopedia of Puns. I'm going into the world of puns. And I always give quick examples for that. What would you call a cow lying in a meadow? Answer, ground beef. What did one fish say to the other fish when they hit the concrete wall? Damn.
So you're going to write a whole book of those?
Oh, yeah.
Did you make all of these up?
No, I'm finding them. Okay. There actually is an annual contest among punsters who make them up on the spot. Mm-hmm. In other words, they'll say barking dog, and these guys have to come up with something. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not doing it to do that. I'm just going to find what I can find that's fitting and humorous. The other one is there's going to be a sequel to this book.
The Glenwood Canyon book. Okay.
Because there's very few interviews in here, and so much of it I can get out of people that are interviewed that could add color to this story.
More legends to the legends.
Yeah.
Because some of these already have quite a bit of color.
Yeah.
Well, Larry Reinierson, thank you very much for coming in.
You betcha, Amy.
And talking with me, and I love your books.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Valley Voices on KDNK. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh.